The year was 1990, which was a long time ago, and I was only 10 years old. I was looking forward to the movie that so many people were looking forward to. You see, it had been 5 years, 5 years since the last Rocky movie had come out. How many of you have ever seen Rocky Balboa? How many of you remember the Rocky movies? The original, before Creed, there was Rocky. How many of you remember Rocky? Raise your hand. How many of you? All right, how many of you have never seen the Rocky movies? Raise your hand. Okay, so you have to understand you're missing a cultural icon, something that's important to our society as a whole. And I had seen, grown up, watching Rocky 1 and Rocky 2 and Rocky 3 and Rocky 4. And Rocky 4 was the pinnacle. Because in Rocky 4, if you don't remember, it was Rocky Balboa with the American flag shorts against Ivan Drago, the Soviet Union communist fighter. How many of you remember what I'm talking about, right? How many of you are already uncomfortable because we're talking about politics in church? How many of you? All right. And this was the moment that we'd all been waiting for, and Ivan Drago versus Rocky Balboa, and it takes place in Russia. And so he has to fly all the way to Russia, and he has to train outside in the snow. And in the midst of all of this, he becomes a great hero to the world. You see, because at the end, America beats the Soviet Union in Ivan Drago. And at the end of the movie, he grabs an American flag and he drapes it over his shoulders like a man does. And he stands up in front of the world and he shouts, "If I can do it, you can do it." Everybody's crying. Americans and Russians crying together. "We all can do it." Extremely articulate. And the Soviet proconsul, everybody stands to their feet and they're all applauding and they're saying, "Rocky, Rocky, Rocky." And the world was united. A couple years later, the Iron Curtain fell and Berlin was free. And most people don't give Rocky Balboa enough credit for that moment. And so everybody was excited. Rocky V was going to come out. It had been 5 years. 5 years. 1990. And everybody goes to the movie theater. Everybody was really excited. And guess what? Rocky V, the absolute stupidest Rocky movie you can find. I mean, it has a Rotten Tomato score of like 12. It's a terrible movie. And the reason it makes me so sad is because it could have been so great. That is the definition of a tragedy. Somebody, something that could have been so great. And it's terrible. Have you ever had a movie disappoint you like that? It could have been so great. Have you ever had a team disappoint you like that? Could have been so great. How many of you ever had a coach? Could have been so great. How many of you had an employee? Man, you hired them and thought, what incredible potential. They could have been great. How many of you had a new job and you went to the job with high expectation, high hopes, and it could have been amazing? How many of you have ever had a friend? And they were supposed to be good. How many of you have ever had a child? And their potential was so real. How many of you have ever had a leader? You think, do you see the possibility of what this person could be? And what makes them a tragedy is what they could have been. That's Samson. Samson's story is a tragedy because he's awesome and he's amazing and the potential of what he could have been. The hero of Israel. The uniter of the people of God. What he could have been was wasted, wasted. He did not live up to his potential. Why? Because fools limit their own potential. Today's sermon is entitled "The Weakest Strong Man." Why? Because though Samson was a strong man, he was weak because as a fool, he limited his own potential. Now, here's the thing. I can't do anything about Samson. He lived 3,000 years ago, and his story both excites me and devastates me. I can't do anything for him, but I can do something for you. That you avoid the pathway of Samson and realize that you can live up to your potential. So what was it? What was it that made Samson so weak? In chapter 15 of the book of Judges, we find four elements to his story that really begin to bubble to the surface, rise to the top. You begin to see how it was that Samson really disappointed who he could have been for Israel, for his people, for his community, for his family, for God. What were those things that made him so weak? There are four here. Number one, petty retaliation. Say it with me. Petty retaliation. Say it again. Petty retaliation. Do you ever struggle with being petty? Oh, gosh, I do. Look at verse 7. Because you did this, Samson vowed, I won't rest until I've taken my vengeance on you. Now, for those who are new to the church, you've picked up right in the middle of a 5-week sermon series, which is the retelling of the story of Samson. And in the story of Samson, in the middle of the series, which you find yourself now, you find yourself in the middle of a part of the story that you need a little background with. You see, Samson had just gone through one of the worst weddings in human history. And you say, well, you weren't at my wedding. Yeah, but you don't know this wedding. This was a bad wedding scenario. He goes down to the neighboring villages. He gets married to a woman. He has 30 different groomsmen, and he makes a bet with them. Well, he loses the bet. He has to go and get 30 sets of clothes, and he can't afford it, so he kills 30 enemies, takes their clothes, and gives them to this guy, these guys. Then he gets upset. He pouts about it, so he leaves the wedding. He moves back with his parents for a few months. There with his parents for a few months, he waits, and finally, when he cools down, he goes back to get his wife. Unbeknownst to him, when he goes back to get his wife has been given away by her father to his best man at the wedding. So now Samson is absolutely angry, livid. And so what he decides to do is go out and catch 300 foxes, light their tails on fire, and throws them into the fields of grain belonging to the Philistines. In doing so, he causes a national poverty problem. He actually creates in the enemies of the people of Israel a famine in the land. And to retaliate against Samson, the Bible says the Philistines go and they take his wife and his father-in-law and burn them to death. Do you notice how the story escalates? You do this to me, I do this to you. You do this to me, I do this to you, back and forth. So now we pick up right there in the middle of that story, because you have done this, Samson vows, I will not rest until I take my revenge on you. So what does he do? He attacks the Philistines with great fury, and he kills many of them. It doesn't say how many. It must have been a lot, because later on it gives specific numbers to how many people he kills later. Then he went to live in the cave in the rock of Edom. So he kills a bunch of people, and he goes by himself and lives in a cave. Why did he do this? Because Samson believed, you don't get mad, you get even. How many have ever heard that phrase before, made famous by Robert F. Kennedy? He said, as a politician, don't get angry. Come on, get him back. This is not a commentary on Robert F. Kennedy. It's a commentary on the philosophy of life. Listen to me. Don't get mad. Don't let him see your emotion. Just get him. This is antithetical to a biblical worldview. This is the opposite of what God would have for you. Why? Because this type of lifestyle will never sustain you. This type of lifestyle is not only destructive to those you're angry with, it's the type of lifestyle that will be self-destructive. Petty retaliation to live in such a way will destroy everybody around you. including yourself. This is what Samson sees, verse 9. The Philistines retaliated by setting up a camp in Judah and spreading out near the town of Lehi. And the men of Judah asked the Philistines, "Why are you coming to attack us?" And the Philistines replied, "We have come to capture Samson. We have to pay him back for what he did to us." Notice, the Philistines come, they attack Israel, they set up a giant camp, and the people of Israel come out and say, "What are you doing coming after us?" And they said, "We have to get back Samson because he got us back for us getting him back because he got us back, and we don't know where it all started." Say, it's confusing. Look up here. So is some of our lives in this room. We're not even sure where it started, but there is this fight, this feud that we develop with other people. And we become obsessed with getting them back. So, what does Israel do? What does Judah do? What does the people of Dan do? Verse 11. So 3,000 men of Judah went down to get Samson at the cave of the Rock of Edom. One of the guys was like, "I think he's probably staying in the cave. You know how he lives in the cave now? Let's go down and get him." So they rallied an army of 3,000 men. By the way, Samson was the judge. That was like the king during that time. He was the leader of Israel for 20 years. In his entire leadership of Israel, this is the only time Israel musters an army. And the army is mustered just to come and get him. It demonstrates what a poor leader Samson actually was. Look what it says. They said to Samson, they arrive in the cave and they say to Samson, "Do you realize that the Philistines rule over us? What are you doing to us?" So all 3,000 men arrive at Samson's cave. And you can picture Samson as he comes out of his cave and he's like, "What do you want?" And they're like, "Don't you understand? The Philistines are our lords." Now, during that time, Israel was not a free country. They lived as desperate tribes scattered around the entire region, living in the fields and living inside of the wildernesses. They did not have a solidified, unified kingdom. And the Philistines kind of lorded over them. They decided how much taxes they would pay. They decided how much freedom they would have. They decided what they could build in their towns and what they couldn't. And so they come and say, "Don't you understand? These are the people in charge of us." Now, this was Samson's moment. Samson could have risen to leadership and taken control as a godly leader he was supposed to be. He could have been like David, who would come 100 years later, who stood up in the midst of a moment like that and said, men of Israel, is there not a cause worth fighting for?" But he didn't. When they came to him and said, "Don't you understand the Philistines rule over us?" He could have been like Daniel, who comes 400 years later, who stood and said, "There is only one ruler over the kingdoms of men, and that is God." But he didn't. He could have been like Jesus Christ, who came 1,000 years later, who was approached by a very similar question, to which Jesus said, "Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God's." And he could have, in this moment, risen to the level of leadership that Samson was supposed to take, but he doesn't. Look at his answer. Look at Samson's answer, and you will get the essence of why Samson failed. It says, "But Samson replied, 'I only did to them what they did to me.'" This is often the excuse that we give when we end up burning the lives around us. But the men of Judah told him, "We have come to tie you up and hand you over to the Philistines." "All right," said Samson, "but promise me that you won't kill me yourselves." "We will only tie you up and hand you over to the Philistines," they replied. "We won't kill you." So they tied him up with two new ropes and they brought him up to deliver him. Do you struggle with petty retaliation? I do. I mean, I have for a long time. I remember Heather and I were first married when we were 20 years old. That's very young to get married, but it worked out well for us. So far, so good. Fingers crossed. 20 years old, and we lived in Pensacola, Florida. I was not done with college. She had already graduated, and we were about to finish up a year there and then move back to Las Vegas. So there we were. We rented a little flat, a one-bedroom apartment, very small. And I remember when you first get married, if you haven't yet been married, you'll notice this. Though you love one another, you also get on each other's nerves. How many of you want to say an amen to that? Don't do it. Just shh, bad idea. Okay. See, I gave you an opportunity and everything. You know what I mean? So we were just getting on each other's nerves, the little things, you know, the little things that bother you most. And I don't know what it was. I'm not sure what we were fighting about, but I remember with a very distinct memory, now this some 23, 25 years ago, I can remember that we had had a fight. I believe it was in the realm of intimacy, simply because we were early married and we were still learning a lot of things about each other and about expectations. And I was frustrated, angry. I was so angry, I wanted to demonstrate my anger by walking out of the room. And when you walk out of the room in the midst of a fight, there's an art to it. What you say, how you say it, how you stand, how you open the door, how you close the door. All of these things matter to make a point. And I performed perfectly. I walked up to the door. I said what I said. I was glad about what I said. I opened the door. I walked out dramatically, slammed the door, and I thought, you know what I could have said was this. How many of you ever thought about the thing you could have said after you said the thing you did say? Man, that would have got her. I was fuming. I was like so much energy and anger inside of me. And I looked around my one-bedroom apartment. I thought, there's nowhere to go. There's nowhere to go. And I thought, what am I going to do? And then I thought, well, I'll just go. And I'm like, where do you go? There's nowhere to go. All my friends live in the dorms. I don't really live in the dorms. So I looked around. And I'm like, well, I can't afford a hotel room because we are poor. So, okay, well, I know what I'll do. I'll go, and in the South, they have porches, screened porches. And we had a little screened porch, just big enough to, you know, store a few things, like my fishing pole and like a few outdoor chairs and a sleeping bag. So I went out there, I laid out, and I laid there on my sleeping bag. I said, this'll show her. And the whole time I'm like, well, I wonder what she's feeling. How many of you know what she was feeling? Do you know? She's totally asleep. She's feeling nothing other than thank God he's out. You know, how many, some of you ladies are like, oh, you know, I do know the trick. That's what's going on. I know exactly what's happening. I laid there and I fumed. And I fantasized about things that I could do to her. Like mean things. Like I remember thinking we had beef stroganoff that we had made for dinner. And hamburger helper, can I get an amen, right? And we always had beef stroganoff, and I remember thinking, oh, we're taking that to lunch tomorrow. I'm supposed to get up and fix it and put it in the little warm containers and all. And you know what I'm gonna do? I'm not gonna put salt in hers. No salt. And then when we're eating lunch tomorrow, I'll be like, how's your no salt? You say, that's very petty. Mm-hmm. I thought of all sorts of stupid little things. Like I thought, you know what I could do? I could hide some of her workout tapes. She had those VHS workout tapes. I could hide them. And then I thought, I'm only hurting myself. I can't do that, right? A lot of relationships live in this dynamic of petty retaliation. You do this to me, I do this to you, and it escalates. So it goes from no salt to you get extremely salty. Do you understand the reason why Samson failed is because Samson always had the attitude, I will get them back. That's the way the world does it. That's not the way the people of God are to do it. You say, well, if I don't get vengeance, who's gonna get vengeance? God says, vengeance is mine. I will repay. I'll take care of them. You take care of me. And so what we see here is that there is something and someone with Samson. He could not let it go. Before I move on, I ask the question, I think there's someone in this room who is obsessed with getting even. It's like you've got to get them back for what they've done. And here's the message for you today. You will never get ahead if you're only trying to get even. I want you to come to church and be freed. Some of you are shackled. And you need to know that you'll never get ahead if you're only trying to get even. Number one, petty retaliation. This is what made Samson not live up to his potential. Number two, prideful isolation. Prideful isolation. Say it with me. Prideful isolation. I'm going to say number two, you say prideful isolation. Number two, prideful isolation. Strong men have a tendency toward isolation. Now listen to me, men. Listen to me. I'm not trying to pick on you. I'm trying to help you. Because I, as an extremely strong man, I feel betrayed by you. Because strong men, because I am a strong man, you know it as well as I do. We tend to rest upon our strength to do everything that we need to do for ourselves. And so what we often do is we isolate and we think it's stoic. It's not stoic, it's stupid. Your pride is leading you to be by yourself. This is why you're not supposed to just come to church on Sunday. This is why we create small groups where men can get with men and share what they are going through, what their understanding of the Bible is, what they need for themselves to be authentic and honest about their struggles. And there are men in this room who think, I'm too strong for that, but you're the weakest strong man. Specifically, we just started a group for first responders and veterans. Sure, yeah, give them a round of applause. Why? We have another, and there's a bunch of groups like this, but we just started a brand new one. Why did we do this? If you're interested, let me know. Come talk to Pastor Caleb. Or if you need any small group after the service, come right up here, talk to Pastor Caleb, the guy with the beard. Why? Here's why. Because men need each other. And if you're here today and think you're the exception, so did Samson as he lived in the cave by himself. Look what happens to the poor guy. He says in verses 14 and 15, as Samson arrived in Lehi, the Philistines came shouting in triumph. But the Spirit of the Lord came powerfully upon Samson, and he snapped the ropes of his arms as they were burned strands of flax, and they fell from his wrists. Okay, the Philistines have him. He's bound up with these ropes that his friends put on him. He arrives in the town of Lehi, which is inside of the area of the Philistines, and they're celebrating. They're like, we got Samson! We got him! Everybody knew who Samson was. He was famous as the leader of Israel. He snaps them in two, and the Bible says, then he found the jawbone of a recently deceased donkey. And he picked it up. Now picture this. He's just walking along. He sees a donkey, dead donkey. He sees the jawbone. He reaches down. He grabs the jawbone. He rips off whatever flesh is remaining. And look, this is crazy. And he killed 1,000 Philistines with it. So there are 1,000 people that are carrying him back home. He grabs a jawbone and he starts slashing away. Okay, I gotta be honest, I gotta see this movie. You know what I mean? Like not some Hollywood ripoff. Like I wanna see that. You say, you're disgusting. I'll tell you, sure. I gotta see that movie. You say, Pastor, would you like to travel back in time and be there? No, because Samson's not smart enough to realize I might be one of the Philistines. I just want to see it on screen. He kills 1,000 people with this jawbone of a donkey. Some of you might say, well, why didn't he grab a sword? Well, first of all, obviously he himself was, chained. roped. And secondly, there were not a lot of swords in Israel at all. You say, why were there no swords in Israel? Did they not have swords during that time period in history? No, there were lots of swords. But you see, a couple decades before this, Israel had made a peace treaty with the Philistines. The Philistines and the Israelites had had a peace treaty of mutual disarmament. You say, they didn't have like nuclear weapons. No, they didn't. But back then they would have blacksmiths. And the blacksmiths would create swords. And so what they did, Israel agreed with the Philistines and the Philistines agreed with Israel to go and destroy all their own blacksmiths so that they would no longer create swords, so they would have peace. Smart idea, right? Until you realize you can't trust the enemy. So Israel, because they're trying to do the right thing, they go and they destroy all their blacksmiths. But guess what the Philistines did? They did not destroy all their blacksmiths. And so you know what happens years later? Years later, this happens for decades. In fact, the big story, whenever David becomes king, he has a friend named Jonathan, who is the son of Saul. Jonathan has a sword. It's a big deal because it was one of the only swords in Israel because of this. Because of this. And so there was no sword in the hand of Samson, just a jawbone. And he goes around and he kills 1,000 of the enemy. Why? Because you don't need a sword when you have God on your side. You don't need any of these things when God is empowering you. Now, I know some of you are thinking, wait a second, how is God empowering a guy who is so morally questionable? Again, I said this last week. You are in sermon number 3 of a 5-week series. Sermon number 5 is going to answer the question for you. How could God use mightily and come upon mightily somebody who is so morally questionable? We're going to get to that in point number 5, sermon number 5. But in the meantime, he grabs the jawbone of the donkey and he starts swinging around. And the craziest thing about this story is while he is killing 1,000 people, Samson writes his own theme song and begins singing it out loud. You don't believe me? Look what the scripture says. And then Samson said, with the jawbone of a donkey, I have piled them in a heaps. With the jawbone of a donkey, I have killed 1,000 men. You see, how do you know it's a song? Because in the Hebrew, it's written as poetry. And when he finished his boasting, he threw away the jawbone, and the place was called the Jawbone Hill. Now, this song is fascinating, and we know it's fascinating when you look at the original language. The Old Testament was written in Hebrew. Look at the Hebrew, and you'll see how funny this song is. While he is killing 1,000 people, he makes a poetic song. Hamar means donkey. Homar means heap. It rhymed. It was a beautiful song. This is the intelligence and the humor of the guy Samson. He was quite a character. The song in English would be better translated, with the jawbone of an ass, I have piled them in a mass. With the jawbone of an ass, I have kicked them in the butt. This translation really does give you the sense of the humor, of the smart aleckiness of it, the irreverence of it. And the most irreverent thing about the whole song is not the words he used, but that he sang it about himself. He was pridefully isolated. Because Samson needed no one but Samson. How does he end up in chains? How does he end up ashamed? How does Samson, the person that was supposed to be the hero, ends up a mess? Well, because of petty retaliation, prideful isolation, and then number 3, an entitled disposition. I'm going to say number 3, you say entitled disposition. Number 3, entitled disposition. You ever met somebody that was entitled? How many of you work in food service? Anybody work in the food service industry? Raise your hand. How many of you? All right. How many of you ever dealt with a customer a little bit, little entitled? I've given you $7. I don't know why you're not acting like my slave. You ever dealt with this? Man, there's nothing worse than dealing with an entitled individual.
Yet I want to stop and I want to say this. Listen now, listen. I've learned the older I get, the more entitled I feel. See, a lot of older people like me love to look at the younger generation and say, look how entitled they are. But here's what I've learned, and maybe I'm the only one. Maybe I'm the only older person in the room who feels this way. The older I get, the more I think, I know what I've done. I know what I deserve. And when people don't treat me the way I know I deserve, then I am not okay inside. And here's the crazy thing about it. I'm also old enough to know when to show it and when not to. So I just walk around with a smile on my face and I talk about other people being entitled, but I'm raging inside because they don't treat me the way I deserve to be treated. Oh, this is what ruined Samson. Look at his entitled disposition in verse 18. Samson was now very thirsty, as one is after killing, you know what it's like after you kill 1,000 people with a jawbone? So he's thirsty. Wants a Gatorade. Samson was now very thirsty, and he cried out to the Lord. Have you a cup? Listen what his prayer is to God. Listen to the words of his prayer to God. You have accomplished this great victory. Good start. By the strength of your servant. Must I now die of thirst and fall into the hands of these pagans? This is his prayer. Look at what I've done for you. Now you're going to let me die and be thrown into the hands of the Philistines? This is his prayer. And so God caused water to gush out of the hollow of the ground of Lehi. And Samson was revived as he drank. So God performs a miracle. Water gushes out of Lehi. Now, some of your translations might say, and water gushed out of the jawbone of the donkey. Right? So some translations literally read, as he cracks the jawbone of the donkey, he drinks water that comes out of the hollow of the jawbone. Others' translations say, water gushed out of Lehi or the ground, and he drank there. You say, well, which one is it? Well, the problem has to do with the original languages. You see, the word Lehi, it means jawbone, and it also is the name of the area, Jawbone Hill. And so translators don't know what to do with that. So some have translated, it came out of Lehi, and some translated, it came out of Lehi. Both are accurate, and a lot of people spend a lot of time, well, which one was it? The answer is, it doesn't matter. People are gonna come up to me afterward and like, I really think it was out of the jawbone. I'll be like, that's great, man. That's good, that's good. So other people are gonna be like, I think it was right out of the ground. It's right out of the ground. I'll be like, that's great. And I'll be, the entire time I'll be like, are you entitled to an answer? I don't. Cause like, that's the point. The point is he goes to God and he says, I've done what you told me to do, which is not exactly accurate. Now give me water. And this is what we do to God. My father is not a perfect man. But he is a wonderful Christian. He's a pastor as well. In fact, he's going to be preaching in our church this December for a special Sunday when we get into the new building. My father, growing up, I would often hear him say this phrase. People would come to him, like he would go on a vacation trip or he's like about to leave for a week or two. He's like, okay, church, I'm about to leave for 2 weeks on a family vacation. And people would come to him and they'll say, Pastor, I overheard him say this many times. They'll say, Pastor, you deserve a break, which is very kind. And my father would always say exactly the same thing. He would say, thank you, but I deserve nothing but hell. And I remember even as a kid, I'm like, that is so weird. Like, don't say that. He would say it all the time. People would pat him on the back and say, Pastor, you've done a great job. You really deserve credit for this. And he would always say, I deserve nothing but hell. And I remember being awkwardly embarrassed by that until I grew older and I realized he wasn't saying it to them. He was saying it to himself. He was reminding himself, the only good you have in life is because of God's grace, not you. David Tice, you deserved, because of your sin, to die apart from God and go to hell. You deserve, because of what you've done to others and what you've done to him, to never have grace from God. But God, in his mercy and grace and love, died upon the cross to pay for your sins, was buried and rose from the grave, and by his goodness, he offered you salvation. So anything above hell is a bonus. And I've tried to live my life that way, even though I don't say the weird phrase. Samson, number four, why did Samson lose it? Number four, what made Samson so weak? Cruel indifference. I'm gonna say number four, you say cruel indifference. Number four, cruel indifference. This is the last one, folks. What do you call a man who flirts? Let me rephrase. What do you call a married man who flirts with another woman? Don't say it out loud. Okay, another question. What do you call a married man who flirts with another woman in front of his wife? Why is that worse? You say, well, it's not technically worse. It's just incredibly cruel. Here is the issue with Samson. Samson completely could care less about God's feelings. God is the one he's supposed to be married to. God is the one he's supposed to follow. God is the person he's supposed to live for. But you know who Samson lives for? Samson lives for Samson anytime he wants. And so he does what he does anytime he wants to do what he wants to do. Why? Because he has a cruel indifference to how God feels about anything. Look at verse 1. Look at what verse 1 says. It says, one day Samson went to the Philistine town of Gaza and spent the night with a prostitute. Not only was he going to take advantage of a trafficked woman, not only was he going to the enemy city to do so, gloating because nobody could take away his strength as a man, Samson was flagrant in his disobedience to God, even though God saw every moment of his life and he could care less. He doesn't care. Why? Because here's what Samson cares about. Look, when it comes down to it, Samson cares about Samson. So if God sees it, well, forget God. He'll forgive me later. What do I care? I mean, he uses me now. He'll use me tomorrow. He kind of needs me, you know what I mean? He needs me. And the power of Samson drains quickly because he just could care less about God. So while he's there in Gaza with the prostitute, words soon spread that Samson was there. So the men of Gaza gathered together and waited all night by the town gates. They kept quiet during the night, saying to themselves, when the light of morning has come, we will kill Samson. Do you see? He's trapped. Have you ever had that moment where you were almost caught in your sin? The secret was almost out. Life was almost ruined. And God, by his mercy, gave you one more chance. Verse 3, but Samson stayed in bed only until midnight, and something got him up. At midnight, he gets up, and he walks to the city gate that was already closed. He was trapped inside. And he took hold of the doors of the town gate, including the two posts, and he lifts them up, bar and all. And he puts them on his shoulders and he carries them all the way to the top of the hill across from Hebron, which is a city in Israel. And so God empowers Samson one more time And because God is merciful, gives him one more chance to get right or get dead. See, for some of you, you already know what happens at the end of chapter 16. But Samson genuinely doesn't care. He doesn't care about God, doesn't care about Israel, doesn't care about his fellow soldiers. He had this huge potential to be and do something. And he blew it all. I can imagine Samson in the prison as he's thinking through his life, thinks about his father, Manoah. He thinks about his best man at his wedding. He's now thinking about the Israelite soldiers who saw him do all of these incredible things. They needed a leader. And instead they got Samson. You say, Pastor Josh, I don't think I've been the leader I need to be in my life. Okay, neither was Samson. You say, maybe the next leader. Well, the next one would be a guy named Saul. He didn't turn out too good. David had his issues. And Solomon, but golly, Solomon. And it's almost like the entire Bible is hungering and thirsting for a hero to come, a king, a lord, a master who could actually save his people. If you're here today and you say, Pastor Josh, I don't think I'm the hero I need to be. Well, it could be that Jesus Christ needs to be the hero for you. And then once you follow Christ, the Lord, you can begin patterning your life after him and become a better leader than Samson ever was. Yeah? Yeah.